Hey, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of the Fawcast. We hesitate to even call it a Fawcast a little bit just because of the content that we're going to be talking about today. We view this as I was joking on an earlier Fawcast, sometimes you had shows that were based on comedies, but they would have a special episode related to something more serious, like child abductions or whatever the case may be. And this is one of those instances. I'm pleased to have Noreen Ghosh in today. For those of you that are not familiar with the case, I'm going to let Noreen bring you up to speed on that. But essentially, her son Johnny was kidnapped in September of 1982, so a long time ago. But I grew up hearing about this case, and I've always been fascinated by it. It probably remains, somewhat depending upon how you phrase it, Iowa's biggest unsolved mystery or biggest open case, so to speak. So, Noreen, thanks for coming in. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
So let's jump right in. September 5th, 1982, obviously a date that you'll never, ever forget. And I know a lot about the case, and Adam Gray here with us knows a lot about the case too. But I want you to inform people, just go back to the basics of what happened that morning. And as this case kind of unfolds and the days continued and the years followed, you learned a lot more about what potentially happened to your son on that day. But take us back to September 5th, 1982, just to bring some people up to speed about what we're talking about.
Okay. On September 5th, 1982, my son got up to go and do his Des Moines Register Sunday paper route. And he had asked the night before if he could do it by himself. He said, well, you know, all the other boys, they do it themselves. And I always have to have Dad or you with me. Can I do it myself? I'm old enough. And I said, well, they're all 14 and 15. You're 12.
Mm-hmm.
So your dad will go with you. Well, the next morning, Johnny decided to do it on his own to show us he could do it. And he took off from the house to go gather his papers to fold. He had our little dog with him. And so they were walking together up the street along Ashworth Road when a car pulled up. And it was a blue over blue car, Mercury Zephyr, that style.
And to interject real quick, the reason you know this is there were other people around that morning, other paper boys, et cetera.
There were witnesses that all saw this. And the man hollered out the window that he was asking for directions to a certain street. Johnny kept walking, according to what the witnesses told us. When he got to the corner, the other kids were sitting there folding their papers, so he was loading the bundles of papers in the wagon he was pulling. Sunday morning was heavy
papers. Heavy paper, yep. Yep, I remember that day. Yep.
Well, the man made a U-turn in the street, came back up and pulled his car in right by the curb where the kids were sitting and folding. He started asking questions after he opened the passenger door and swung his feet out on the curb. And he kept garbling his words like he either was drunk or had a speech impediment. We weren't sure. And he kept asking where a certain street was. And Johnny said to one of the other kids, there's really something weird about this guy. He said, I'm scared. I'm going to go.
Mm-hmm.
So he headed down the street with the wagon loaded full of papers. He didn't stay there to fold them.
Mm-hmm.
And he got partway away from there over onto the other sidewalk. When the man pulled his feet back into the car, slammed the door, started the engine, and before he pulled away from the curb, he reached up and flicked the dome light three times.
Okay.
That's when you still had switches on dome
sure.
lights.
Sure, yep.
Then he sped away. Johnny continued walking down the street on the sidewalk, and out from between two houses came a very tall, thin man. They estimated his height to be about 6'5",
okay.
and very thin. And he came down and just fell in behind Johnny. I doubt, looking back on it, I doubt very much if Johnny even knew he was being followed. Because
mm-hmm.
the guy just kind of crept along, and Johnny was pulling a wagon, which would make noise.
Yep.
So he got to the next corner, and Johnny turned. At that time, the blue car that contained the man that was asking all the questions, he had gone full circle all the way around that section
mm-hmm.
and came back up on a side street and parked his car. As Johnny turned, the back door opened, somebody got out, and the man that was following Johnny shot him with something and he dropped to the ground, and then they loaded him in the car, slammed the doors, and ran the stop sign heading north on Marquardt Lane. Excuse me, I'm sorry, 42nd Street. Mm-hmm. And he was grabbed on Marquardt. And then that street led north to the interstate.
Mm-hmm.
And we assumed that they had gone directly to the interstate. And it took a little while before we found out the rest of the information on that. But there was a boy in his bedroom. And it was fall, nice weather, so he had his window open. And he heard a scuffle and some noise outside. So he looked out the window. And he's the one that saw Johnny being shot with something.
Mm-hmm.
And he dropped to the ground. Now, this was probably years before stun guns became available. So
okay.
I don't know what they would have used, but that's what he said that he saw.
Now, that information did not come out at the time.
No.
Of that. Was he not interviewed, or what's the speculation on why that wasn't made? Because obviously, another element of the case that people aren't aware of, and you can talk about this as well, is that the West Des Moines Police Department was the one primarily investigating this, and they immediately treated it as a runaway, which that information directly contradicts that it was an abduction. Mm-hmm. So was it simply that they weren't trying to find the answers at that time, or was that particular child not willing to talk about what he had seen?
I'll get to that. The morning that this happened, they had a head start. They had left the area with Johnny. We didn't know that he was missing until someone called us saying they had a late paper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Johnny had never had a late paper the whole year and a half that he had had the paper route.
Mm-hmm.
So that was odd. My husband went to go see if he could help Johnny on the route, figuring he was just running late. He came racing back to the house and said, call the police right away. His wagon is sitting up at the corner full of papers. Not even one bundle was cut.
Yep.
So I called the West Des Moines police, and we waited 45 minutes for them to come to our house.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived 10 blocks from the police station.
Yep.
In that time, I called the district manager, and I got the names and contact information for all of the boys that were at that corner, including the 44-year-old attorney that came to pick up his son's papers and also saw the man and heard him.
Sure.
And got a partial license plate. That man was an attorney who later became a judge in Des Moines, very reputable.
Mm-hmm.
So I had all their statements written down of exactly what happened, when, and where. And at that moment, I didn't know about the kid in his bedroom who saw the rest of it. When the policeman got there, I started telling him what had happened. And he said, well, let's fill out the missing persons report. I said, okay. We got all through, and then I showed him the tablet I had with all the statements from the witnesses and their contact information. And the cop looked at me and said, well, has your son ever run away before? I said, he's never run away, ever.
Mm-hmm.
Not today, not any time.
Yep.
Well, he left the house. And then he finally did go to the homes of the other kids. But he didn't even bring in a piece of paper or a tablet or anything to write even one word down that they had to say about the abduction. Not one word. And the reason I know that is because the parents of the other kids called me and told me.
Mm-hmm.
They said, what's going on? I said, I don't know. We're going to find out. Well, as the day wore on, we did not see any more police until mid-afternoon. So what we did, we started calling friends around the city, asking if they would organize search parties, go to abandoned places, maybe industrial parks that might be deserted on a weekend, state parks, any place where you think that somebody might have dumped somebody.
Yeah,
we were preparing for the worst. Well, all of a sudden in the afternoon, 23 people showed up on my front lawn, angry, upset, confused. They had been searching out at the state park when a West Des Moines police car pulled up, and out got the police chief, climbed up on a picnic table, and he used a bullhorn, and he began yelling to the crowd, everybody go home. This kid is nothing but a GD runaway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were angry.
And this was the day of.
That was the day of.
Correct. Okay.
Well, these people were angry, upset, They said, we want to help you, but it appears you don't want help. I said, oh, we didn't sanction that.
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out why any police chief would do something like that when a little boy's life hung in the balance.
Yeah.
Really. So we didn't see the police chief at all that day. Mm-hmm. He never came to our house. And when I called the police station, they said he was out.
And at the time, too, it's important to note, not that it was an excuse, but the law was different. Then it was 72 hours roughly. Explain the difference between if a child got abducted today versus back in 1982.
Well, there was no law. That was the problem. There was no law saying they had to wait 72 hours or that they didn't have to wait.
Mm-hmm.
It was just something that they assumed and did. But now if there would have been a car stolen or a bank robbery, they would have been on it.
Yeah.
The first hour.
Yeah.
But for a human being, no.
Yeah.
But there was no law, because when I researched into it and began writing laws and getting them passed, I checked out what was already on the Iowa code and what was not. There was no law pertaining to that.
Okay.
But they like to use that to push parents away.
Yeah.
Well, after the incident out at the state park, I called the FBI office. They sent someone over the next day, and when the two agents came in, they identified themselves as special agents. I didn't think they were so special. When they walked in, they got no more than 2 feet inside our hallway, and they said, we will not be entering the case.
Hmm.
I said, why not? Kidnapping is a federal crime. And here were the two reasons they gave. Well, the police chief called us, and he doesn't want us. He doesn't want our help.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell they were kind of choking on their words. Well, then the other one said, well, it's up to you to prove that your child's life is in danger.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I said, get out.
Mm-hmm.
Get out of my house.
Yeah.
He said, what? One of them did, and the other one was kind of sputtering. And I said, get out of my house. If you're not going to help us, get out of our way. I've got work to do.
Yeah.
Well, we continued with our own personal searches and then began searching for a private investigator who has had experience in kidnapped children cases. And word got to the police chief that we were going to be interviewing for private investigators. He came over to our home, and when he came in, he began screaming and yelling at me and stamping his foot on the floor like a 3-year-old throwing a tantrum, because he couldn't have a sucker or a lollipop.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at him and I said, well, first of all, there's no need for you to yell. I have perfect hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't yell at one another in this house.
Mm-hmm.
So if you continue, you will have to leave.
Yeah.
And he said, you can't talk to me that way. I'm the police chief and I make the decisions on this case. And he started pounding on the table. And I said, oh, no, you don't. I said, when you stood up on that picnic table and broadcast to everyone that Johnny was nothing but a GD runaway, you forfeited the right. It's not your case.
Yeah.
And I said, I am running this case.
Mm-hmm.
And I will hire somebody that will work for me. There won't be any filters that the information goes through. If he wants to get paid, he will turn the reports to me.
Mm-hmm.
And police chief got angry again and started yelling, so I grabbed his arm, opened the door, and shoved him out on the porch.
I probably would have done the same under the circumstances.
They should have filmed that.
It seems to me that and obviously the circumstances were dictating your behavior, but it seemed like instead...
My behavior?
Well, and I'll explain this. So you became almost an immediate advocate for your son, which was good. That's exactly what you should have done, versus being able to having the police handle it and just kind of be a grief-stricken mother and all of those things.
Yeah.
Is that just your personality that's just tenacious and just wanted to get to the bottom of it? Obviously, if any of us, had our children abducted, we would say that we would do anything we needed to do to get them back. You're proof that that's exactly what you've done then, that day, and for the next 34 years. Where does that part of you come from? I mean, were you just so ticked at the West Des Moines police at that point that you just had to do what you were doing?
I was the only one that was doing what was right.
Yeah.
They weren't. They were covering something, and you could see it.
Yeah.
They were disregarding the statements from an attorney in Des Moines
mm-hmm.
who saw what happened.
Yeah.
who saw what happened. Not, and there were kids there too, 14 and 15 year olds. They are the ones that supplied us with the best description of the car and the paint colors.
Mm-hmm.
And then we took those kids to the dealership to pick out the paint chips.
Mm-hmm.
Then we ran them under mercury vapor lights, which were the street lights, and they changed colors.
Mm-hmm.
So we did all of our homework and detective work. My behavior, mm-hmm. as you put it,
mm-hmm.
was the right thing to do.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
And there is no way I will tell any, or I will take that kind of verbal abuse mm-hmm. from anyone. I don't care how big a badge he wears or not,
mm-hmm.
FBI or not.
Mm-hmm.
They were refusing to even look for my child.
Yeah.
Now, when I give speeches, and I've given hundreds of them,
yep.
I tell this part of the story first, slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, now, the reason I'm sharing this with you is because these are the red flags that were flying high. Something was wrong with this investigation from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if you were faced with that and somebody had come into your neighborhood and taken your child and the only two law enforcement agencies were refusing to help, what would you do?
Exactly what you did in this instance.
And I say this when I speak in schools. If this happened to your parents and somebody had taken you, what would your parents have done? If the FBI says, we're not mm-hmm. entering the case.
Mm-hmm.
Police says he's a goddamn runaway. I mean, what part of professionalism is that? There is none.
Yeah.
I mean, was he born in a barn?
Yeah.
Well, then part of the problem with all of his behavior was that he made statements to the news media mm-hmm. that Johnny was nothing but a runaway. Well, that presented us with quite a problem, because then public opinion and the things that people say come back to you with phone calls, nasty phone calls, all that accompanied this.
Yeah.
At a time when we were hurting the most with our son gone.
Yeah.
And no help. None.
Which is almost unfathomable to think of that happening today because of how things have changed.
Well, and today there's a social media platform where you could have used your voice on a daily and hourly basis to kind of get
Plus Amber Alerts and everything else that we have today.
There were not even PCs in people's homes back when Johnny was kidnapped.
Yeah.
Having internet in your home was like a pipe dream.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody, you know, had to come up with that before it became a reality. And I remember in the early days, I was at a missing children's conference, because there were small groups that were forming that had been treated like we were. So they would have conferences. And I remember being at this one conference, and the Canadian Mounted Police were there, and they were speakers. And the man kept saying, in a short time, we will be able to uplink a child's picture across the world in as little as 20 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept referring to the information superhighway.
Yep.
Well, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, what is that? I hadn't heard of that. So I leaned over to the lady next to me. I said, what the devil is the information superhighway? She says, I don't know. Well, it was the internet he was talking about.
Yep.
In its early stages, but that was even light years before it got into people's homes.
Yeah, 1982 definitely seems like another time in history.
It was.
So you obviously, you've retold the story a bunch of times. You have a certain way that I'm sure that you like to tell it, but I wanted to at least try to, as you're telling the story, ask a few other questions, because later, I believe 1999, correct me, that's where Paul Bonassi enters the scene, and a lot more information about what potentially happened to your son came out,
mm-hmm.
but that's a lot. That's 17 years between when Johnny was abducted in 1999. During those 17 years, and I definitely want to get to what did happen.
Paul Bonassi came forward in 1989.
89.
And then the court case was 99.
Okay. So, just as Johnny's mother, what were you doing in that period of time? Obviously, looking for your son. That all goes mm-hmm. without saying,
right.
But. You know, obviously, were you assuming the worst at this point? What were you doing on a daily basis to kind of get through this process and try to find answers?
Okay. On a daily basis, we worked with our private investigator, which we ultimately did hire. He was good. He created a network in a circular fashion and a radius from our home
mm-hmm.
in which they went home to home to home and did interviews. When he got to this one house, this is the amazing thing that happened. Mm-hmm. He knocked on the door, and a man came to the door, and he said, we are here to ask you a few questions about the Johnny Gosch case. And the man said, well, thank God you finally came. And the detective looked at him, and he said, what do you mean? He says, I've been calling the police station day after day after day, trying to tell them what I saw that morning. Mm-hmm. And see, he lived off on a side street, but still within that radius of our home. Okay. He said, I got up to get a drink of water, because it was early in the morning. And he said, I could hear a motor running. So I looked outside, and there was this van parked, but it was parked the wrong direction to traffic. So it kind of caught my interest. I watched it, didn't turn on any lights. And he said, all of a sudden, up pulled a blue car. And they unloaded something long from the back seat and put it in this van. And then they all took off and headed to the right, which was back north again to the interstate. Uh-huh. And my detective couldn't believe it. It was like we struck gold. Uh-huh. He wrote down everything the man had to say. Police never, ever to this day went to talk to him. When the detective came back to me, he said, here is this report. Bury it. Uh-huh. Do not speak of it. Do not show it to anybody. And of all people, do not give it to the police. They will torch it and say it never happened.
Yep.
So we did. Then, during the years that followed until Benassi came forward, we were busy running down every lead we possibly would get. Every TV show that was a national show would yield more information because Johnny was taken outside the state, so we needed that. And then in the meantime, I began researching the lack of legislation for children in a kidnap situation, sexually abused kids in the courtroom, those type of things. And I began writing legislation at home. And then I would make an appointment with the governor and take in my proposals. If he thought it would pass, if it could actually work, he would give it to his committee to put into the legalese and then find sponsors in the House and the Senate, and then we went forward with it. And I was severely criticized for not hiring a lobbyist and not going that route to try and get a law passed. And I said, why should I do that and give you money to take some fat cat to dinner?
Yeah.
And just bullshit all over it.
Yeah.
I said, no, I went to the governor because he's got the ultimate veto power. Mm-hmm. That would be the man to talk to.
Yeah.
And I didn't have time.
Skip to the chase, Go right to the top.
And Governor Branstad was wonderful. He really listened. We had the first bill of its kind, the Johnny Gosch bill, which insisted upon an immediate investigation for every child that's missing.
Mm-hmm.
No longer could they take the option of an unwritten law in the sky and wait 72 hours.
Yeah.
It passed. I had members of the Finance Committee verbally take me aside at the Capitol, and they said, well, you think you're so smart and clever getting this bill passed. We controlled the money, so it won't be enforced. I said, oh, okay. Well, I said, I know who you are, so I'm just going to step in and visit with the governor while I'm here and let him know that I've been threatened.
Yeah. Why would they have that reaction? What do you think?
People resist change.
Even if it's to benefit children.
Yes. We had all kinds of difficulty getting legislation passed because of that.
That seems interesting to me, just societally, that people would fight it so much.
Yeah, because at least they were once a child, even if they didn't have kids of their own.
Yeah.
So after the first bill was passed and the governor was signing it in July of 1964,
or 84.
One of those same men who was so cocky in the hallway was standing next to me, and the governor was signing like he does. And the man leaned over to the guy next to him, and he said, we only passed this bill to humor the woman. We'll never need it again. There'll never be another kidnapping here. And I leaned over and I said, you're going to lose by a landslide. You're not going to be reelected. He was running for election that year. I said, you're not going to win.
Yeah.
And he said, what? I said, trust me, you're not going to win. Well, the governor finished and everything, and we went to work.
Mm-hmm.
In all the speeches I had been giving, we were collecting names of legislative contacts in every county. So if a bill was being held hostage by a representative or a senator from that mm-hmm. county, we could generate 500 calls into the state house yep. within an hour.
Yep.
Well, we started a letter-writing campaign with the exact quote from that man
mm-hmm.
that they only passed that bill to humor me. The interesting thing about that was he lost by a landslide. He was never in public office again. But in that time frame of 1984, Eugene Martin was kidnapped in August.
Also a Des Moines Register paper carrier.
But earlier in that summer, we were contacted by a man who said he had information and wanted to meet with us. So we went. And in that meeting, he told us that there was going to be a second kidnapping in Des Moines, that it would be a paper boy, it would be the south side of Des Moines, and it would be the second Sunday in August.
Huh.
And he wanted me to go to the Des Moines police about it. And I said, well, why don't you do it? He said, well, they'll ask me
how
my,
I know.
My source. And I said, yeah. well, they're going to ask me my source, and I'm going to give them your name.
Yeah.
And yeah. he said, what? You're going to give my name? I said, certainly. So I went off to the Des Moines police. They wouldn't let me talk to a detective.
Mm-hmm.
The man said to me, well, we know you've been under a child bill's terrible strain, and we feel you've just snapped.
Mm-hmm.
So I disregarded them, and I went instead to the TV stations.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to the news director at each one. I told them what I learned. I also contacted one person at the Des Moines Register so that somebody knew.
Yep.
Came August that morning. I had just flown home from testifying at a Senate hearing in Washington. Got home, and then the next day, ABC 2020 arrived. They were doing a follow-up story on Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
After we did all the filming, I told the producer about the meeting I had with the man and how he predicted another kidnapping, which would have been the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And the producer said, well, I'm not leaving. I'm staying overnight. So she checked into the hotel. The film crew got on the plane and went back to New York. And then early, early in the morning, I got a phone call from a reporter at one of the TV stations. He was out of breath, just a young kid, and he kept saying, Mrs. Gosh, it's happened. There's been the second kidnapping, just like you said. Exactly like you said. South Side, paper boy, everything is the same as you told us. And they're calling in 18 FBI agents from Quantico to work on it. And the Des Moines police will be organizing a task force. And I said, well, how do you know what I said? I talked to your news director. He said, well, yeah, he came out to the newsroom after you left and told us, and then we all laughed and made jokes that you were nuts. And I said, well, what do you think now?
So the Eugene Martin case, obviously, based on what you've just said, was a targeted event. The kidnapping of your son, you believe, was a targeted event. He was picked out. He was searched out.
Johnny was photographed 2 weeks before the kidnapping, and it was witnessed by a neighbor.
And we haven't touched on this yet, but let's dive into a little bit of the deeper part of why, so people understand. And that's the ugly part. That's the not the you know the child abduction part is horrible, but the reason why, which frankly, there's no other way to put it. It was for the purposes of a pedophile sex ring. Your son was abducted for the purposes of essentially being sold or used for essentially the enjoyment of other people against his will. And maybe Eugene Martin was kidnapped for the same reasons. I know you're not here to talk about that particular case, but when did those details start to come to light for you, and just your opinion, your take on that whole side of this case? Obviously, there's some depravity in our society, and your family has witnessed that firsthand. But I'm interested on your take, and there's a lot of people that frankly don't believe those things happen. And I believe that, unfortunately, we live in a world with a sick side to us, And that's what you've experienced firsthand. So if you can talk about, he's been abducted, what happened from there to your knowledge, and what do people need to know about what happened?
What we know for certain that took place was Johnny was transported to a house, kept there for a little over 2 weeks, photographed. His pictures were spread around for a prospective buyer. The buyer showed up, counted money out on the table to the kidnappers to pay them, and there was a witness to that. And any time you are paid to sell somebody, mm-hmm. that is what they now call human trafficking. They mm-hmm. they didn't have a name for it
yep.
back then. But we had the witness as well. And the thing that gets me is that the people that say that these things don't exist, they better not let their kids out of their sight.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time your child is not with you, there's an opportunity for a pedophile to strike. Either the garden variety pedophile that lives in your community, he's planted there, he's not going anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and he selects and takes the risk of getting caught to grab his own victim. Then there's the other category where they've turned it into a business. And I knew as soon as we started hearing all the reports from the witnesses about the second man on the street walking, one driving,
mm-hmm.
and then the driver of the van, that we were dealing with something much more organized.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to have somebody school me in it. I knew that this was organized crime. It's a different type than we've ever known before.
Yep.
And it's daunting to even think about.
Because
it.
The typical abduction that we see in the nightly news seems to be one person abducting one kid, and they usually end up murdering that child.
That's
unfortunately.
Right.
So the ring, the three people working together, whatever the case may be, I think that's just harder for people to accept.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's been. And I have no question that it happened, but that was your personal experience. That's mm-hmm. what's happened to your family and your son.
In 1985, I worked with the governor on something. We had gotten some information and a letter from a prisoner in an Iowa prison saying that there was a ring operating in northwest Iowa, and they all were using kids, and the kids were all listed with one another. Now, this was in the days before we had computers,
mm-hmm.
so these pedophiles all knew one another, and this guy that came to me through a letter would roll on them
mm-hmm.
to try and get a deal, I guess. Well, my attorney and I went to the prison. We got all of the information. I bypassed the DCI. I bypassed the police and the FBI. And I made an appointment just with Governor Branstad. And I gave it all to him. And I said, you are the only one in the state that can force the DCI to do the job. They need to round up these men. They're hurting kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we busted the first pedophile ring here and got... These men were all arrested. 1985.
Okay.
So it did happen. And they were all up in through the Fort Dodge area and all around
mm-hmm.
that part of the state. Had the prisoner not written to me, I wouldn't have known. He said he had sent letters to the police and to the DCI, and nobody ever responded. I responded.
Mm-hmm.
I went. Mm-hmm. I was willing to sit in that prison and talk to the man
yeah.
and find out. That's the difference. Anytime a lead came in, I would check it out. I wouldn't sit back in my house with my feet up and say, oh, it's probably nothing, boys.
Yeah.
I went.
Yep.
I went with my attorney or private investigator, whoever fit the need the most at that time. And when we went to see this guy, we needed an attorney there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could get the information documented in the right way that it could be handled. Well, that was real, folks. That one happened,
mm-hmm.
and I was a part of it. And both Governor Branstad and I received awards for that because nobody would listen to this fella.
Yeah.
And he wasn't going to go down alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was going to share what he knew. And I don't know whatever happened to him, but that was a reality case.
Yeah.
And so along the way, as well as doing legislation, my job that I kept, I was also doing speeches.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited to speak everywhere communities all over, different civic organizations, schools, churches. People all wanted to know what was happening in our state, because by then Eugene Martin was kidnapped too. Yep. So that's two out of Des Moines. And so I was very, very busy through those years. And then when Paul Benassi came forward, he was put in jail for committing another crime. His attorney, he confessed to about Johnny.
So Paul Benassi confessed to being there the morning that your son was kidnapped and part of it.
He was the one in the back seat. Well, then his attorney hired a private investigator to not only vet what he said, confirm, throw it out, throw it in the case, it was a reality, or he was lying. Well, everything they checked was accurate. And I had nothing to do with hiring that private investigator. That was by the attorney. Well, then the private investigator contacted us and brought me all the tapes of all the interviews they did with Paul Benassi when he told the whole story. And he said, we want to take you to the prison so he can see you face to face.
Yeah.
And so they set the plan with the warden, and we were going to go. And then I thought, wait a minute, we need to document this big time.
Yeah.
So I called WHO, and one of the reporters that I had worked with, who seemed to be very open to this case and helpful, I asked him if he would want to go along and make a documentary to show during Sweeps Week. Well, they jumped at the chance, and thank God we did.
Yeah.
We went to the prison. They were setting up equipment. I was standing there. They brought Paul Benassi in chains. Now, he didn't know who he was meeting with at that point. And I glanced over at him, and he looked at me, and at that very second, I knew I was going to hear the truth about what happened to Johnny.
What did that feel like to you, that feeling at that time?
I was standing there. The cameraman was adjusting the camera. Jim Strickland was on the other side of the table, and I fainted.
Yeah, yeah.
The cameraman ran around and caught me before my head would have hit the concrete wall.
Wow.
They didn't show that in the film.
Yeah.
But it was just an overwhelming thud. It's like, you know that you know.
Yeah.
So Paul came and sat down at the table, and he was introduced to me by the private investigator. He said, do you know who this lady is? He said, no. He said, he's Johnny's mom. Paul just dissolved. Just burst into tears, and he kept saying, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for what happened, what I did. And then he explained very painfully every detail. The kind of stuff you don't want to ever have to hear, but I needed to know from him.
Yeah.
And the boy's telling the truth.
Because he knew, in your mind, he knew very specific things that somebody wouldn't have known about the abduction and about your son. That unless they were with your son and around your son.
Now, going back to that report from the neighbor where the van was spotted.
Yeah.
The report we buried.
Yep.
That we never told a soul. Paul said, because the private investigator didn't even know about that. Paul sat there at the prison and he said, we drove just a few blocks and pulled in. We had a van waiting. He knew the color of the van. He knew which way it was parked. He was telling me all this.
Yeah.
There's no way anybody would have known that had they not been there.
Yeah.
So we were very careful not to just believe willy-nilly everything he said unless we had some way to back it up.
Yeah.
And Paul, to this day, if you were to sit down to interview him about the Johnny Gosch case on that morning, he would repeat word for word exactly what he said to me that day in the prison. He's never altered his story. He is very precise, very articulate, and that is what happened. Paul is a unique personality. If you ask him a question and he has no knowledge of something, he'll just look at you and say, I'm sorry, but I don't know about that. He won't just make up stuff to fill air.
Yeah. And one important distinction for the people listening about Paul Benassi is Paul Benassi at the time was not an adult male. He was 16 at the time.
17.
So he himself had been abducted. Right. And his role in this maybe was to help abduct your son, obviously. But also, according to what I've read, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Paul was one of the first people to actually abuse your son as well, to kind of get right. him into this lifestyle, so to speak.
He was to sexually abuse Johnny on film and was the first one to touch him. And I remember when the private investigator for the attorney came to my home, and we spent hours listening to all this, and he said, well, we want you to go, we'll make arrangements with the warden for you to go to the prison. Now, this was a maximum security.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I just need a couple of weeks to think about all this so that I can walk in there and not feel one shred of animosity. Because I said, right now, I'd like to scratch his eyes out.
Yeah, yeah.
Any mom would. But I said, just give me a couple of weeks. And I said, I'll be just fine. So they gave me a couple of weeks. We set the appointment. Because I knew if I went in there feeling or showing any anger, Paul wouldn't talk.
Yeah.
He wouldn't tell me what we needed to know.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, Paul didn't get any special deals. He didn't get any gifts or special anything. He still had to serve out his sentence. He didn't get a parole by telling me. There was nothing in it for him. He wasn't asking for anything. He just felt that the time had come that I needed to know.
And what this jailhouse meeting, what year was this in? Do you remember the specific year that you met him there at the prison?
I met Paul in right after he had talked to his attorney about all of this. So it was about the latter part of 1989.
Okay. So yeah. seven plus years or so mm-hmm. after the abduction.
After the abduction.
You learned this information, and I assume your natural question is, where is my son now? Do you know where he is? Paul doesn't know at that point. What does that lead you to next in this case? You've just realized all this information. Mm-hmm. Where do you go next?
Paul told us that they moved the kids around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it was so difficult to find Johnny, that they had safe houses. And he told me some of the locations where the safe houses were. And they were way out in the middle of nowhere.
One is in the documentary film. It was in Colorado.
Right.
That they show.
Yeah. And then in the basement area of that house, they had cages built.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul led the America's Most Wanted film team to that house, that location. Somebody set fire to that house after the TV
mm-hmm.
show aired.
Mm-hmm.
And the producers of the America's Most Wanted show, they were just flabbergasted when he led them up into the mountain to where this house was located.
And again, further corroboration that he's telling the truth, he's talking about things before he goes to the house, about initials being carved in wood mm-hmm. down in crawl spaces, and then they get there to film it, and it's exactly as he's described. So there's no question
yeah.
that this is an honest person. I mean, he's been severely damaged by the things he's gone through, but he's telling the truth in these instances.
Paul also told us that one time they were taken to a specific Mexican restaurant in Colorado. And it was a very unique one that had lots of, you know, entertainment, and it had a couple of floors to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that while they were in there, one of the kids had a bottle of red nail polish. And the boys went into the restroom, and in the mortar
mm-hmm.
with the Mexican tile decor,
mm-hmm.
they wrote their names with this colored bright red paint.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And none of that was ever released to the press. None of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a couple of years later, some friends of ours were on a trip, and they stopped at the Mexican restaurant. Didn't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
No history. We hadn't talked about it. And one of them in the group went to the restroom, and they saw this written in the mortar.
Mm-hmm.
Paul was telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, they found it not knowing any of this was part of Johnny's case
yeah.
that we had been told.
Completely unconnected, or uh-huh. so they thought at the time.
And so our private investigator went and took photographs of it, and they still have it in their evidence. But there's been so many things that link Paul, the truth that he told. When we asked him where did you take Johnny that morning? Where did you go? Well, we went to a house, and who owned the house? Well, he told us. Could you sketch a picture of him? Could you do that? Because he only knew him by Charlie.
Was this house in Iowa or outside of Iowa?
Sioux City.
Okay.
Outside of Sioux City.
Okay.
So he only knew the man. The men only gave first names.
Yeah.
Paul sat down, and he's quite an artist. He sketched this man. The private investigator hired by the attorney took it and went to speak to the county attorney there, went through all the mug books, and bingo, we found the guy.
Hmm.
Found the property. The guy had a rap sheet as long as your arm for sexual offenses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the house they kept Johnny in for 2 weeks.
Okay.
And so we were able to trace that part back. There's just been so many things, and Paul is the key to the case. And had the police gone and talked to him, they would know these things. But they never did. They wouldn't. And in the new Netflix movie, Who Took Johnny, they question the one lieutenant, he's retired now, but they questioned him, and then one of the other guys that's still on the force, and they said, well, when are you going to go and talk to Paul Benassi? And they said, well, he said, we'll go when we're good and ready.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been 34 years. Aren't you ready yet?
No. Yeah.
Most people, when there's this kind of compelling information, even if you decided you didn't believe it, mm-hmm. you'd want to go just to disprove it.
Yeah.
West Des Moines Police didn't go. Now, there are a number of very good men on the West Des Moines Police Force now. Way back when this happened, Johnny's case, it was shoved off. It was treated like a runaway. We did not get the help, as you know, those first few days and the incidents that I told you about where the red flags were flying,
yeah.
that set the tone for the investigation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sorry that they did that, because if they could have worked with us, we might have found him.
Mm-hmm.
Could have maybe prevented Eugene Martin.
Yeah.
And then with all of this information, you still have to work through the jurisdictional police
mm-hmm.
department.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told by one of the men that worked there that when a different police chief came in, because Orville Cooney left.
Yep.
And he was making so many bad decisions on our case publicly that I made a phone call to a number of members of the city council
mm-hmm.
on a Friday afternoon. And I told him I was going to be filing a $20 million lawsuit on Monday morning, naming him negligent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had an emergency, unpublished meeting of the police or the council on
mm-hmm.
a Sunday night. Unpublished is against the law. Monday morning, big headlines. Orville Cooney resigns
mm-hmm.
due to stress.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was his stress.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I never
should have been.
and I never intended to sue them. I was way too busy looking for my son.
Yeah.
But I wanted them. I wanted to see what they would do.
Yeah.
And they immediately dumped him. He was a liability.
Why do you think? Let me ask you a specific question here. Why do you think? And maybe Paul addressed this, but why? Why specifically was your son targeted in West Des Moines, Iowa, when this ring was in Sioux City or in Omaha or outside of Iowa? Just really, really bad luck? Or was there more? Is there more to that, in your opinion?
Did you ever hear about people that were going to schools, playgrounds, and taking pictures of kids?
Not really.
That's, okay.
Yeah.
Because that was quite prevalent in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
A neighbor saw Johnny walking home from school. This was 2 weeks before he was kidnapped. And a car with California plates pulled up, and a man leaned out and had a real long lens. Now, this is in the days before digital cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Had the long telephoto lens. It just began clicking Johnny as he walked.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the neighbor got really upset, so she called the police department to report it. And I know the officer she talked to, and they told her it's not against the law to take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't fault them on that, because it wasn't against the
yeah.
law. So police threw away the license number, so mm-hmm. did the lady.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then 2 weeks later, Johnny was kidnapped. And that lost evidence was gone.
Yeah.
But Paul Benassi told us that one particular man who had a vehicle there at the kidnapping site that morning, he was the one that brought pictures of Johnny to the motel room where they stayed and said, this is the kid we're taking tomorrow. Hmm. Johnny was targeted.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But maybe not up until the night before. It could have been, in theory, another child, but that somebody at some point said, is the one.
No, his pictures were taken 2 weeks beforehand, but the man that delivered the photos, they probably had a lot of them to look at during that two-week period, and then Johnny was chosen, yes.
And that was just based off probably particular tastes. That's why he picked...
They probably had a pedophile that they were selling to.
Yeah.
And when I testified before Senate hearings... They had a big table like this one. And on there was one piece of paraphernalia after another that was all confiscated by the FBI during pedophile arrests. Well, one such thing was a big three-ring binder, big, thick book,
mm-hmm.
filled with kids' pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to the FBI agent standing there, I said, I don't recognize any of these kids' pictures. I said, when were these kids kidnapped?
Mm-hmm.
He said, they haven't been. He said, this is the catalog they use.
Mm-hmm.
They go out, they send men out to take pictures of kids. They're put in books. These catalogs are shown to pedophiles. They pick the one they want. And then they're willing to pay for it. And then somebody goes out and takes that child. Well, the internet did away with all of that. They no longer had to have the physical book.
Yeah.
Now they do it on the internet.
Yeah.
But I was horrified to see that because it was turned into a big business. And back in the day, when they could have done something about this, they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the director of the FBI a few years ago before Oprah Winfrey went to her own network. It was one of her last shows.
Yeah.
The director of the FBI stood there and said, on pornography and human trafficking, we've lost the war.
Mm-hmm.
He stood there and admitted that to America. Well, that's true. I think it is so big now, they don't even know where to start. And then I've had people say to me, oh, that's just rubbish. You're making that up. That doesn't happen. So then I say this. When a lone pedophile wants a child for his own desires, what does he do? He drives around. He sees a kid he likes. He watches the kid, waits for the best time to grab him mm-hmm. so as not to get caught. He takes the risk.
Yeah.
I said, what do you suppose a rich one does?
Not that.
Somebody that has maybe a title, means, money,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't want to get caught,
yep.
would not want to be exposed.
Yep.
He pays somebody.
To go do that.
And then that starts the chain of those that find the kids, the candidates of what they want, get pictures maybe. Put them on the internet now. They make a selection. It's all very well planned. You got to give them that. They are organized. And if we are not organized to protect our children, if we take an ostrich syndrome position and mm-hmm. stick our head in the sand and wave our rear ends in the air and say, oh, this does not happen. Well, it does happen, folks.
Yeah.
It does. And it might not happen here again for a while. But I had the shock of my life a few years ago. I got a call from the National Center for Missing Children. Robert Lowry, who was the president at that time. And he said, Noreen, did you know that you have a third kidnapping in Des Moines in 1986? I said, no, I didn't know that. He said, well, I found it in a cold case file. It's a Des Moines case. They called it a kidnapping, and the boy's name is Mark Allen,
mm-hmm.
taken in March of 86. And so they overnighted me the whole package on Mark. Got it the next day. I called Jan Michelson, and I said, could I come on your show this week? He says, is there something new on Johnny? I said, no, but you're not going to believe what I'm bringing you.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the station, and for several hours, we talked about Mark Allen's case. What happened? Why didn't the public know for 25 years? Johnny's case, Eugene Martin's, the connections, the similarities. if you put all three of the boys' pictures side by side, they look like they could be related.
Yeah.
So we took it very seriously. And it took a while to find Mark's family because his mom had moved in with their grown son now, so she didn't have her own address anymore. But when I finally had a chance to talk to her, I said, I wish you would have called me. I said I would have helped you.
Uh-huh.
And she said, when the police came here, we did the missing persons report. They lectured me on not talking to the press. Don't tell anyone. We'll handle everything.
Mm-hmm.
And for God's sake, don't call that Noreen Gosh. She's nothing but a troublemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what do you think now? And she said, I have never been so lonely in my entire life. She said, Mark's case didn't get any attention, no media coverage. People don't even know he's missing.
Yeah.
Until you did the show with Jan Michelson.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I wish I would have disobeyed the police and I wish I would have called you. Well, you know, that's a big red flag too, because we passed the Johnny Gosch bill ensuring every child would get an investigation.
Yeah.
So basically they broke a law and nobody held them accountable. And Mark is gone.
And you're right. I mean, I specifically remember a lot about your son's case, Eugene Martin, and very little about the other, if anything. So you're absolutely right about that. It didn't get play anywhere near the other ones.
No, Aaron Brobeck, after that all happened, I went down and met with him at WHO, and he was doing a series on coal cases mm-hmm. in Des Moines. And so he included Mark in that and did a very nice piece on it. But until Jan Michelson and Aaron Brobeck did those stories, nobody really knew about Mark's.
So there's, and obviously we're under some time constraints, but moving the story forward, I do want you to address the part, because a lot of people, again, that aren't familiar with the case would think that you never saw your son again, you have no idea where he is, but as part of the story goes, that isn't the case. And I don't know the year, so you'll have to tell me that, but at some point you said that you did see your son again. He came back to your house.
Once. In the late 1996, I was invited to be on the Lisa Gibbons talk show in California twice that month. On the second show taping, they asked each mother that was there if they wanted to give a personal message to their child that was missing.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the camera to ourselves, and we did. And my message to Johnny was that I loved him and that I would help him no matter what. No matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And that I no longer lived in the family home, but he could find my address in a Des Moines phone book.
Mm-hmm.
That was December. Wasn't until March there was a knock on my door, and I was living alone, and I got up and I went and I looked out into the hallway, and there was a young man there and then another young man that I didn't recognize at all, but the one seemed familiar through the eyes and
mm-hmm.
the face.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, who's there? And the voice said, it's me, Mom, it's Johnny.
So this is 14 years, roughly.
He was 28 when he came.
Okay.
And now, that statement he made, it's me, Mom, it's Johnny, is not important to anybody else but me.
Mm-hmm.
But when our kids were growing up, I taught them that a closed door means you knock
mm-hmm.
out of courtesy
mm-hmm.
to whoever is in that room,
yeah.
if it's their bedroom or whatever.
Yeah.
So when Johnny was little, he would march up and he'd knock on a door, and one of the other kids would say, well, who is it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's me, it's Johnny. Or if he was knocking on my door, he'd say, it's me, Mom, it's Johnny.
Yeah.
Same phrase came out exactly
yeah.
as he did it as a little boy.
Yeah.
So I let them come in. The one boy didn't say anything at all, but Johnny came because I told him I would help him no matter what on that TV interview. And so he went through what he wanted to see happen, and that was that the men that did this, robbed them of their childhood, would pay. And I said, what would really help is if you would stay
mm-hmm.
and be able to give your story, or maybe they could block out your face, do something for your safety, but at least that. And then you convince the other kids that you know that are still alive that were in these rings to do the same. There's safety in numbers. And I said, we'll arrange for a safe place for you to live. And the two guys got very alarmed and they said, oh, we can't stay. We can't. And nobody can know that we were here.
Mm-hmm.
because they will kill you. And that's what they had been told. If you try to reach out to your parents, we'll kill your parents.
Yeah.
So they were operating under fear. They stayed about an hour and a half. And then in that time, they decided they had to go. Now, it was the middle of the night. So I walked outside with them. And then they walked off into the darkness. And it was quite a while before I heard an engine start up. They didn't even feel safe enough to pull a car close to where I lived. They walked a ways. And, you know, in that time of night when there's nothing else going on, everybody's sleeping, you hear sounds very easily.
Yeah.
Well, during that time, I told no one. Absolutely no one for several years.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was in court as a witness, the attorney asked me, when I was on the witness stand, have you ever talked to or seen your son at all since he was kidnapped?
Yeah.
And I remained silent. And the judge instructed me that I had to answer the question or I'd be considered in contempt. I said, once.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked, you know, what the circumstances were, so I told very briefly. Well, in the back of the room was a reporter for the Associated Press, and she wrote down everything and went right to a phone, and that's how it got out all across the country. Or I probably still wouldn't have told anybody because I was honoring what my son asked me, but I wasn't going to be thrown in jail.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning and end of it. That's where I learned a lot more about how the traffickers operated, how they moved the kids around, and then once the kids outlived their usefulness, some were killed and their bodies were dumped. We came upon some in our investigation. And then other kids were brought into the business, or some of them were just dumped with no education, no job skills.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't go home because one of the things they do early on when they take these kids, they force them to commit a felony. And so they hold that over their heads. Well, you committed a felony. You can't go to the police for help, so you better not run away. And people say, oh, but those kids could have run away any time. People do not understand what happens. If you're 11, 12 years old, and you're taken away from everything you knew, everything, you don't even have a toothbrush anymore, and you're with men that are drugging you, forcing you to do things that you never even heard of before, and then throwing in the threats of what they'll do to you and your mom, your dad, your brother, your sister, whatever your family is. That's what those kids grow up with. And it produces such a fear that even if they saw a policeman across the street, they wouldn't run for it.
Yeah.
They are that terrified.
Yeah. And I'm reminded of the Elizabeth Smart case. She eventually asked for help, but she had opportunities before that where she could have asked somebody. So people that play those assumption games, it doesn't work like that. But I think that what's helped people come to the realization that there are serious issues in this country. A couple of ones that jumped to mind, I think 2002, you had the Boston Globe write about the pedophile issue in the church. You had the Penn State scandal happen. So this stuff is out there, people.
It
is definitely out there. I think that what would you say? So I'm trying to think of a couple ways to wrap this up. One thing I want to point people in the direction of, which we don't have enough time to cover, but the Franklin credit union scandal out of Omaha has a lot to do potentially with your son in explaining the pedophile ring, some powerful people that were over in Omaha that had a taste for kids. There's really no other way to say it. But do their own digging on the internet. There's a lot about this case that's fascinating that helps explain a little bit more about this world. What would you say? It's easy again. I grew up carrying paper, so I was scared I was going to be abducted because of what I'd heard. And the reality is, this is still Central Iowa. For the most part, it's still a pretty safe place. Most children, sadly, the statistic I saw was 74% of children that are abducted and killed are killed within 3 hours of being abducted. So certain people just want to do that, not for the purposes of a ring or anything like that, just to quickly fulfill a desire and then unfortunately get rid of the child. So those things happen. We hear about them in national news, etc. So I don't think people should live in fear, but they should also be cognizant of the fact that these things are out there. There's people that want to hurt children out there. What would be your advice to people, just in general, when it comes to kids? Should they have a paper route by themselves in the early morning? What are your thoughts on that?
For a time after all the kidnappings here, the Des Moines Register stopped having kids deliver papers, and they used adult carriers. Then I think they've kind of gone back to maybe some kids do it now. But a lot of parents wouldn't let their kids do it after the two paper carriers were taken. So, and, you know, carrying papers is a very noble thing to do. You learn the work ethic. You learn how to manage money, be responsible. It was a good thing for kids. And then something like this ruins that opportunity for them. Parents need to be vigilant and know who their kids are with, where they go with those kids. Because every time your kids are not with you, it is an opportunity for a pedophile, whether they act on it or not. Pedophiles choose an age bracket, and they usually stay within that age bracket to molest. When they get tired of that kid or the kid has grown up, they move on to somebody else. And pedophiles carry on quite a history of a career of molesting kids. People think, oh, well, they did it once, they did their time, they're cured. No, they're not cured. And in the state of Iowa, since 2003, we have had chemical castration as a sentencing tool. The judges will not use it. And one excuse that was given to me was, well, it makes the prisoner feel bad.
Yeah, that's what we should care about.
Well, and that, you know, this deprives them of their feeling of manhood. Well, too bad. What did he do to the child?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think we just need to take a stand of, are we going to protect people like this, or are we going to protect our children? And I am definitely a proponent for the death penalty. I've lobbied for it many years, and people don't want it. And they say, well, it's not a deterrent. Well, perhaps it doesn't stop somebody from committing a crime, but if you catch the person that does commit a double felony, class A felony, and they get the death penalty, you at least know that guy's not going to do it again.
Yeah.
And that many children that he might have touched would be safe.
Yeah.
Now, the case in Minnesota,
the Wetterling
Jacob
case.
Wetterling,
his body was just found recently.
They had to promise him in writing, in an agreement, that they would drop the murder charge against Jacob in order for him to show where the body was.
And since you've been in that position as the mother of an abducted child, did you fully support their decision to do whatever they needed to do to get an answer?
Each parent has to do what they feel in their heart is best for them and their existing family. And if that's what gave them peace, then that's what they needed to do. I, however, would not do that. I would hold out for the murder charge and see him convicted. Because he is, what did they say his age was now, 53? Well, he's going to get 20 years. He could be out when he's 73 unless he gets parole in there, unless parole is restricted.
Yeah.
He's still young enough to start up another career of molesting kids.
Yeah.
That's my point.
Yeah. Well, Jerry Sandusky, I don't think was that old, but he was in his 60s for sure at Penn State and still very active.
Exactly.
Let me somewhat wrap it with this, and I want to give you a chance. I know you have a book about the subject, and obviously the Netflix documentary is a must-watch as well, but... how would you sum up your relationship right now to the case and your son, who you believe is still very much alive and out there? Where do things exist for you today, as far as the case goes?
When it comes to Johnny, no one has given us any indication, proof, or evidence that his life has been taken. And I've had and worked with very good detectives, men who were FBI agents, retired, and went into private work. Police detectives who specialized in trafficking cases. Those are the men I worked with. They know how to get information. There has been a trail of information that we have followed on Johnny, and it supports that he is still alive. He will not come forward. He doesn't have to. He's not the guilty one. He is living under another identity. The last that we had a report, and living his life. Now, it's not the life I would like to see. I'd like to be able to have him come over for dinner, you know.
How old would he be today?
Family. He'll be 47 November 12th.
So the reality is, at one point, he was an abducted kid, but now he'd be a 47-year-old man, and maybe he does have his own life and possibly a family, et cetera.
And probably does have his own life. works to support himself or whoever he's responsible for. So at that point, that hasn't changed in that dynamic yet. Maybe it will. Would he ever come back to Des Moines? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being, could you imagine what it would be like
mm-hmm.
for him or Eugene Martin
yeah.
or Mark Allen to do that?
Mm-hmm.
They would be open to all sorts of things
mm-hmm.
that could come flying at them, from the worst element all the way to the milk of human kindness
yeah.
and everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be very difficult for them. This isn't what I would want, but right now, you know, I'm sorry, but being a parent is not about what you always want.
Yeah.
It's about what's best for your child.
Sure.
And right now, this is what's best for him if he is still living. Last report, he was, but things can change.
Yep.
But as for the case, I respond to information that comes in that needs to be checked out. I'm not a fool. I know that people come up with information many years later. They think of something, they remember something, and then they don't even know if it's important, but it can be.
Yeah.
So I still work the case as needed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have detectives on retainer because it isn't needed right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I can place a phone call very quickly if I have to.
So if somebody wants to read your perspective on this, I know you wrote a book about that. How would they find that book?
The book is called Why Johnny Can't Come Home, and I retain all of the rest of the inventory. So all they have to do is get in touch with me. And if they want to reach me, they can write to me at Johnny Gosch Foundation
okay.
at AOL.com.
Okay.
And the movie, as you know and mentioned, is on Netflix currently. I don't know how long Netflix keeps films on, but
I don't know either, but generally for at least a while, especially popular ones. So
well, this one is trending very well, I was told. And the producers of the movie did an excellent job of taking 30 years and putting it on a timeline so
yeah.
that somebody living in Idaho who had never heard about this could follow the story.
Yeah.
And I must get probably 25 or 30 a day
mm-hmm.
messages on either email, text, or that special messenger that's associated with Facebook.
Yep, yep.
And people seek me out to write to me.
Gray.
I was born in 85, and we were actually sitting and doing a podcast last year. Mark mentioned the Johnny Gosch case, and I wasn't familiar with it. So I got caught up via Netflix, the movie, and with the case. How did that come about? Did you reach out to them? Did they reach out to you?
No.
How did that start?
They reached out to me. Someone had mentioned Johnny's case to them because they're all New Yorkers. And they called me and they said, well, we want to do a film, documentary style. And I said, well, I'm not sure I'm interested. And it wasn't about having to go through everything again. It was about whether or not the integrity would be in the story because I'm still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And how they would tell it. Because, see, I've had other movie offers, big ones, and they all wanted to retain total control of the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I will have to be having some input into the storyline because I have no idea what liberties you will take with the truth.
Yeah.
And so I was the one that refused to do them.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was probably about 7 serious movie offers through the years. So when these guys came along, we talked for an entire year before I agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Whole year.
Wow.
And the movie is really good. I've seen it. Adam Gray's seen it. And just to give out the website, there's some more information on you. It is johnnygosch.com. And Gosch is one of those names that I think a lot of people probably misspell, but it's JohnnyGosch. JohnnyGosch.com. You can find Irene's information there. I believe that's where I found it originally. And there's a lot of information at that site, a lot more about the Omaha connection and photos, etc. So it's a very informative website. But Noreen, I wanted to thank you for coming in. Obviously, you took a chance on us. You didn't know who the heck we were. But we just wanted to get this story out there. I just mm-hmm. think it's an Iowa story. It's a story that a lot of people aren't familiar with and should be familiar with.
And it's a story that has lived on through the years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've gotten a couple of invitations to film shows in New York just this last week. And so we'll be seeing about schedules and all of that. And once it's set in stone, then I'll make an announcement. I never do it ahead of time because it can change.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to come in. I mean, I know you've told the story a bunch, but it is still about your son and obviously a very personal story. So thanks for trusting us to get this out there for you and appreciate your take on things.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, guys, that wraps it up for now. Hopefully you enjoy this and spread the word about this case, and we'll talk to you again next week.